most important issue in African historical demography is the enormous growth in total population has occurred over the last 120 years or so. The continent's population has grown eightfold over this period. As you see from this chart, growth is relatively limited between the wars. It accelerated around 1950. And then very fast through until the end of the millennium. No other continent has ever experienced growth on this scale in recorded history. The causes of this immense population growth are quite poorly understood, partly because of the weaknesses, the well-known weaknesses of African historical data, partly because of the extreme localism of demographic change across Africa. There's often as much variation within African countries in demographic trends as there is between countries. So what I've done in my research is to shift the focus of analysis away from national level surveys down to a more local level, to a kind of regional level. And this is essentially because of the extreme ethnic heterogeneity of most African countries. Uganda, the country that I mostly work on, is about the size of the UK, and it has 56 different ethnic groups, some of which speak languages which are entirely unintelligible to each other. Tanzania is four times larger, and it has 126 indigenous ethnic groups. So the paper that I'm giving today arises out of a project which compares the demographic history of three neighbouring societies. Uganda in southern Uganda, Ankole in western Uganda, and Buhaya in northwest Tanzania. So these are neighbouring societies. And they're selected because they are relatively large. They're also have an unusual demographic history. I also chosen because they are culturally very similar. The languages are about 75% identical by core vocabulary. Their traditional religions are almost identical. Their societies are shaped by traditions of monarchical government and so on and so on. So I didn't want to try to work out the differing nature of African historical trends by looking at societies which are fundamentally different, where, for example, one society circumcises, another one doesn't. These are more or less cases of comparing like with like. Over the course of the colonial period, which ran from about 1900 to 1962, give or take, the population of Ankole had one of the fastest growth rates in recorded history. Uganda and Bahia had very slow population growth. Bahia's population more or less stagnated throughout the colonial period. So this extreme variation in demographic trends. What's most significant about the demographic experience of this larger region is that it doesn't fit with the established models which explain African historical change over the 20th century. One school of thought, led by Cordell and Gregory, emphasizes that African population growth was triggered by an increase in fertility. They think that fertility increased because of a reduction in periods of postpartum abstinence and also in breastfeeding. It's assumed in this theory that the increase in fertility was greatest where the colonial impact was most significant. So in the areas that were described as being modernized or developed most intensively. So places where you have intense colonial demands on African labor, either through cash cropping or through labor migration, places with the highest levels of education, Christianization, and so on. It's assumed that these are the places where fertility will rise most quickly in the colonial period, and right across the continent, you tend to see that this pattern is seemingly occurring. The alternative major model focuses on declining mortality. So John Aniff, Jack Baldwell argue that there isn't much evidence, fertility rising before the 1950s in Africa, whereas there is substantial evidence of falling mortality, and they focus on the health impact of the colonial state, with improvements in sanitation, famine control, vaccination, this kind of thing. In the interwar years and then from the 1950s, you get a decline in endemic diseases due to a major expansion of preventive and curative care. For these scholars, African fertility has always been very high because of a cultural pronatalism. They think that fertility did rise further in the colonial period, but only in the last years, and after the decline in mortality was already well established. Within these opposing points of view, there is a large area of agreement, which is that modernization, development, these kinds of terms, problematic terms, explain why populations started to grow in Africa. But in the Great Lakes region dominated by Lake Victoria, the experience was very different. Here, areas like Bihaya, Buganda, but also Banyoro, Teso. Here, the areas that were most developed in the region with the highest levels of literacy, income, Christianization, and so on and so on. These were the areas that were characterized by population decline or stagnation, whereas the areas with the fastest population growth, like Rwanda, Gagezi, and Kole, these were marginal to the colonial economy, they had very low levels of literacy, lower levels of Christianization, and so on. The kind of classic demographic data that exists only provide part of the explanation for this conundrum. So we have to think of other kinds of primary sources that can be used. So for this project, I've done family reconstitution from three Catholic parishes, one in each of the three case study areas. So about 80,000 life events have been used in this reconstitution. I've also used hospital maternity registers from five hospitals across the region, and through that I've got data on 20,000 births. This region has been subject to a number of demographic and medical surveys over the decades. In the colonial period in Bahia alone, there were four major demographic surveys, each of which record the data of several thousand women. I've also done quite a lot of qualitative work. Most importantly, I've spoken to about 400 individuals from the three societies to try to understand how people rationalized the demographic experience that they had. All of these data are problematic, so the rest of the talk is not going to hedge the data too much, but I'm very happy to talk about the weaknesses of the data in questions afterwards. It is worth emphasizing, though, that this was the most Christianized society in equatorial Africa. By 1911, 50% of people in Buganda were already Christians. It's also an area that had the best educational provision in equatorial Africa. In Buganda in particular, remarkably high literacy rates among women by the end of the colonial period. It's also worth noting that in terms of medical care, again, Buganda and Bahia had the highest levels of medical provision in tropical Africa, apart from some parts of the Belt of Congo. So issues of representativeness still exist, but people who were Christian, who were literate, were not as exceptional as they are in much of the rest of Africa in this era. Obviously, this in itself raises questions about the broader comparative value of what I'm talking about, but that's another issue. So the overall argument of the paper is that what might be termed modernization or development tended to have unexpected demographic outcomes across the region. The first issue that I want to focus on is marriage age. And the church registers are problematic sources for marriage age because of the problems of censoring. It's particularly true for Tsibi and Yamitanga, where the baptism registers are only for infants. But once you get to about 1940 or so, the censoring problem is less significant, and the data are, I think, comparative value. The broad trend in this mid to late colonial period is one of broad stability. In female marriage age, there is evidence of a decline in age of first marriage for women. But overall, the trend in the church records does not suggest that falling marriage age is the major trigger for rapid population growth. This is a finding which fits well with the retrospective data, which reflected soon after independence, around 1960. Oral informants in Buganda and Bahia emphasized that marriage was not simply a matter of finance, that while economic development technically made marriage more affordable for some young men, their strategies of securing status were now also shaped by education, employment, and new material and social desires. And these factors tended to work against people marrying early. In Ankole, meanwhile, a survey conducted in the late 1950s helps explain why labour migration doesn't seem to have triggered a significant decline in marriage age for men. The ethnographer who did this research interviewed a large number of male labour migrants from Ankole. And what he found was that there were three groups within this community of migrant labourers. A third of the men were the poorest in the society, and these men had to make at least six annual trips to Buganda to secure the funds needed for marriage. These men told Stenning that they probably would never have been able to marry in the past, that labour migration has helped them to marry. Stenning argues that for these people, labour migration doesn't help them to marry earlier, it just helps them to marry full stop. Another third of the men went to Uganda for 1 or 2 years to top up the wealth that they had in terms of livestock in order to accelerate their marriage. So for about a third of the men, they did marry earlier than they otherwise would have done, it seems. For the last third, they reported that they already had the wealth to marry, but they chose not to marry as young as they could. They wanted to go to Uganda to earn money in order to invest in material goods, in order to achieve a kind of modern lifestyle that they aspire to. So the overall impact of labor migration, according to Stenning's study, is more or less zero in terms of the age at which men married. More, what's really important with labor migration is that it enabled almost all men to marry at some point in their lives. And that, it seems, has not historically been the case. Another outcome of the work on the parish registers is that it doesn't seem that there's a very significant relationship between economic change and patterns of birth spacing. The increased demand for household labour for cash crop production was, in Buganda and Bihaya, more likely to result in the employment of labour migrants rather than the enlargement of family size. Where profit margins from cash cropping were particularly high, and where subfertility was the norm, i.e. in Buganda and Bihaya, during the 1920s through the 50s, interviews emphasized that using paid labor was the logical response to changing market opportunities. Informants told me that child labor was of almost no value until the kids were about 7 or 8, and at that point, in the mid-colonial period in Buganda and Bihaya, parents didn't want to have the kids working on the farm. They wanted the kids to be in school. These societies had, as I said, the highest rate of educational provision in East Africa at this time. So parents made a decision, typically, to invest in their children's future earning potential rather than their immediate labour value. In Ankole's more marginal rural economy, by contrast, some informants did support the neo-Marxist thesis that the development of a modern economy supported pronatalism. A few interviewees claimed that polygamy remained common in Ankole because some men appreciated the economic potential of having large numbers of children in an economy that was increasingly focusing on cash cropping. According to one interviewee, one of her neighbours even dressed as children in a uniform. When they turned 10, they'd be given a hoe and a uniform and put to dig. They would be like labourers to him. So again, these data should not be taken as accurate representations of what true birth spacing probably was in this period. The data are problematic in various ways, but they are of comparative value. And again, what they show is that the society which has which was characterized by labor migration, Yamitanga, doesn't experience the greatest decline in birth spacing. And therefore, the neo-Marxist theory doesn't quite fit. Even informants who emphasize that some people did desire a larger family because of the economic benefits of child labor didn't argue that birth intervals were the mechanism through which this desire was achieved. Instead, what interviewees emphasized was that birth intervals declined, primarily because of a changing perception of the risk to the mother's health and to the likely survival of the child. It was assumed that when the risk to the survival of the mother and the child reduced, then it was safer to reduce the duration of breastfeeding. This is a slightly surprising thing to hear. Secondary reasons that were given included the growing sense in propaganda that breast milk was an inadequate nutritional foodstuff for children over the age of 6 months. This is something that was commonly believed, it seems, from the early 1950s. And overall, the story of birth intervals is that there is substantial decline over the course of the colonial period. In Buganda, birth intervals fall by 10 months from the start of the period through to about 1970. Yet the neo-Marxist emphasis on marriage age and birth spacing as the key determinants of population growth through rising fertility does not fit well with the data that arise from the parish reconstitutions. These figures here are not meant to be, again, an accurate representation of actual family size, and there are issues of censoring at the start, of course. They are, again, of comparative value. And what they indicate is more or less what we already know, which is that Nyamitanga and Ankole had much higher fertility levels over this period than Chisubi and Bukoba. And yet, it's Chisubi which had the largest decline in birth intervals, and it's Bukoba which had the lowest age at marriage. So it seems that the issues or the determinants which the neo-Marxist historical demographers that have focused on in this region, at least, are not the best explanatory factors. Overall evidence that's been collected for this project indicates that fertility rose in these three societies at different times, mainly because of an increase in the proportion of women in union and a decline in the incidence of primary and secondary sterility. And the reason why Buganda and Bihaya experience this increase in fertility later than Ankole is essentially because of the unexpected negative consequences of modernization. That's something I should have mentioned before. In Ankole, the sense that it is a decline in childlessness, which is the fundamental factor, is given by these data from the 1948 census, which indicate that the childlessness had fallen substantially over the interwar period. Other data show that marriage had become almost universal in Ankole by the 1930s. There had been a relatively low marriage rate according to the 1911 and 1921 census. Ankole by the late colonial period was well known for having almost universal marriage. A large 1972 survey found that 97% of women by the time had been married by the time they reached 35. So this is an area that was known for very high levels of marriage and for low levels of childlessness by the 1940s, 50s. In Buganda and Buhaya, cash cropping was associated with strained spousal relations. Wives took on much of the new work that was associated with producing cotton and coffee for the market, but their husbands took the wealth that was generated. Contemporary sources and oral interviews emphasized that a crisis in marriage had developed by the third decade of the 20th century in both Buhaya and Buganda because of cash cropping. Buganda had the lowest marriage rate in Uganda after 1920, right through to the 1970s. Various religious and secular reports emphasize that young people here in Buganda increasingly chose never to marry at all. By 1931, like a quarter of Buganda women had never married. Both Buganda and Buhaya had exceptionally high divorce rates in addition. So in Buhaya, in 1954, there's a major survey of marriage. And this found that only half of ever married women in their 20s were still with their first husbands. And the reason for this was predominantly divorce in almost 80% of the cases where marriage had ended. So divorce was very common, and remarriage was far from automatic. Only 58% of divorcees in Buhaya, 58% of divorcees in Buhaya had not been married by the time of this survey. Contemporary sources and also oral interviewees emphasize that sexuality in these societies had become increasingly materialistic during the interwar period. A typically extreme quote from a colonial official in 1938 claimed that almost any higher woman can be induced by the payment of sixpence to sleep with almost any man. Interviews sometimes made statements that were almost as extreme. Several referred to affairs as being unavoidable or inevitable or universal in this era. And repeatedly, people emphasized that this was linked to the materialization of sex. The issue of women leaving their marriages from Buhaya and becoming sex workers right across the region, and every other major town in East Africa, dominated Haya political discourse through the colonial period. Haya women formed the majority of sex workers in every major town in East Africa by the 1940s. One unsurprising consequence of this materialization of sex was that both Buganda and Buhaya had exceptionally high levels of STD incidence. In the early 1940s, 20% of military recruits from Buhaya were found to have gonorrhea. Obviously, there are issues of diagnostic accuracy, but this is much, much higher than anywhere else in East Africa. In the 1950s, doctors working in the Bukoba Hospital here reported that they had experienced the highest rate of destructive gynecological sequelae from gonorrhea, higher than they'd ever encountered anywhere else during their careers. Buganda was not quite so extreme, but a quarter of married women in Buganda in their 30s had never given birth in 1948. In Buhaya, the key problem was secondary rather than primary sterility. major medical survey in the early 1950s found that 51% of higher women in their 20s who'd been pregnant in the past had not conceived in the past 8 years. For women in the 30s, the proportion rose to a startling 88%. So it was because that the average woman's reproductive life came to such a premature end that the fertility levels in Bahia were so low. There are several reasons why this pattern came to an end, but in Bahia, in the mid to late 1950s, there was a program of mass treatment of STDs with penicillin. This program dispensed with the difficult and time-consuming problem of testing people and reportedly simply treated everybody that they encountered with penicillin, every adult. This was one of the most significant medical programs of the colonial period in East Africa. Partly as a consequence of this, there was a dramatic transformation in fertility levels. In 1952, a major survey estimated that the total fertility rate in Bahia was 3. The 1967 census reported that it was 7.2. So there does seem to have been a major shift in demographic patterns. In colonial Africa, progressive policymakers typically associated labour migration with social and moral breakdown, and they endeavoured to stabilise the rural workforce on the land, classically by stimulating cash crop production. Yet in this region, the societies like Ankole, like Gezi, like Rwanda, like the areas of northern Uganda that sent tens of thousands of workers every year to the Sudan and Uganda, these peripheral areas that supplied labour migrants had much lower levels of STDs than did the areas of cash cropping around Lake Victoria. The much more stable marriage, much lower divorce rates as well. And this seemed contradictory to colonial officials working in this area. They couldn't understand why families that were repeatedly split up due to labour migration, where men were going to live away from their wives for sustained periods, didn't have higher levels of STDs. Surveys in Ankole in the 1950s through the 1970s reported that the level of gonorrhea was one of the lowest in Uganda. The reasons, it seems, why sexuality in Ankole was more risk averse than in Uganda and Bahia, it seems we're linked to an ethnic competition, a sub-ethnic competition within Ankole, and also a religious competition. Ankole is divided between pastoralists and agriculturalists. There are very tense relations between the two communities. It's also split between Catholics and Protestants. The colonial sources indicate that the rivalry between these groups led to politics being dominated by issues of morality, a kind of competitive morality. So what you find from the sources in Ankole in the 1920s and 1930s is intense pressure from chiefs on people to marry and to stay married. And it seems that this did have an impact in this society. Elderly Ankole interviewees discussed sexuality using language of fear and reserve, in marked contrast to their Uganda and Haile contemporaries. So it seems that in Ankole, people had larger families than the Baganda and Bahia because they stayed together longer and because they suffered far lower levels of sterility, especially secondary sterility. With regard to health and mortality more broadly, it's again a story of Ankole seemingly overperforming and Baganda and Bahia underperforming. Ankole's disadvantages were significant. In 1959, calcium per capita in Ankole was 5 times lower than it was in Baganda. Medical attendances per capita in Ankole were 3 times lower than they were in Baganda and Bahia. And at the end of the colonial period, in Ankole, only 5% of women of childbearing age had been to school. In Bahia, the proportion was 25%. In Baganda, it was 36%. Levels of mortality were not viewed overall worse than their richer neighbours, despite their obvious disadvantages. In part, this reflected Ankole's natural advantages, which were that Ankole here was at higher altitude and was also drier than Baganda and Bahia. These territories were quite swampy, and the soils were not very free draining. There's much higher level of malaria around Lake Victoria than there was in Ankole. But on top of this natural advantage, people in Ankole chose to invest what little wealth they had in livestock. So that in Ankole, livestock possession was 3 times higher per capita than it was near the coast, near the shore. And also, the distribution of livestock was much more equitable in Ankole than it was further to the east and south. So malnutrition in Ankole, partly because of this, was much less significant than it was in Baganda and Bahia, which were much wealthier societies. In Bahia, women were affected by severe gender taboos on what foodstuffs they could consume. Typically, women were restricted in terms of access to protein-rich foodstuffs. In 1951, a major survey of body weight in Bahia found that the average woman in her 20s had a BMI, a body mass index, of 19.9, which is technically underweight according to the British Nutrition Foundation's definition. It's probable, therefore, that a significant proportion of women at this time were severely underweight, given that this was the average, and therefore likely to have been subfertile. Although BMI tends to reduce the number of live births a woman has over her lifetime because of issues around an ovulation, late menarche. A very large proportion of female informants in Bahia claim to have commenced menstruation at an advanced age. One claimed that 18 was the normal age among her contemporaries. A large number of women, about a quarter of women, claim that they first menstruated between the ages of 17 and 19. It was common for women to say that they were married before they had reached sexual maturity. And it's likely that many of these women, as a consequence, would have suffered gynecological problems arising from premature sexual experience. Doctors working in this area emphasize the severity of pelvic inflammatory disease among higher women and noted that it was common even among women who did not suffer STDs. In Buganda, the taboos that limited female diets were largely abandoned by the 1920s. Women's diets improved substantially between the wars. These hospital records from hospitals in maternity centers in Kampala are obviously problematic because maternity attendance became much more common over time. But still, there is a suggestive trend of a rising level of birth weight between the wars and thereafter. And obviously this had benefits in terms of infant survival. But there was a generation of women who were producing substantially larger babies than had historically been the case. The birth rates of babies increased substantially between the wars. Female stature in Buganda was the subject of a number of medical papers in this era, which emphasized that the average pelvic size of Uganda women was the smallest on record. So one paper in 1932 recorded that a fifth of maternity patients had a contracted pelvis and noted that the average pelvic outlet in Uganda was 14% smaller than that of women in England and Wales, whereas the average fetal skull was only 5% smaller. There was described what was described as an epidemic of disproportion in Buganda in this era. Buganda had exceptionally high levels of stillbirth, maternal mortality, and neonatal mortality. The medical records of the hospitals in Buganda are full of women suffering ruptured uterus and so on. So what you have then is this sense that it took women a generation to get over this this change in diet for their physique to catch up with the size of their babies. In the late 1950s, a follow-up study found that women's pelvic size had increased substantially, and that the kind of problem of disproportion had been substantially reduced. Buganda's rapid development had other unexpected nutritional consequences. Historically, Ugandan mothers had often sent their babies away to live with an aunt or grandmother to force the child to adjust to the termination of breastfeeding. In mid-colonial period, it was found that many mothers were ending breastfeeding earlier than had traditionally been the case because of pressure from the churches, a desire to return to employment or trading, or a sense that bottle feeding was superior. The sharpest fall in birth intervals in Kasubi Parish in Buganda, year 2.8 months, occurred in the early 1950s and coincided with the moment when bottle feeding became extremely common. By 1960, 42% of Uganda babies in central Buganda were bottle fed. It's an exceptionally high level for Africa in this era. Surveys of women in the 1950s who attended child welfare clinics found that the typical period of breastfeeding had halved in recent years. toward Feldman's. So what you find in Baganda in this period is what we report to be the highest levels of kwashiorkor in tropical Africa. And these were associated with the emotional trauma of children being fostered out at a very young age. The cultural tradition of weaning children onto a high carbohydrate diet. And also the high incidence of gastroenteritis associated with bottle feeding in unhygienic conditions. So standards of health in Buganda and Bahia were lower than would have been expected for such wealthy, well-educated societies and such excellent medical services. But Ankole's mortality data are better than would be expected given its poverty and relative neglect. And it's not simply due to relatively low levels of malaria. So look at this graph, then what we see is that Ankole here and here and here does not suffer significantly higher infant mortality according to these kinds of sources compared to the richer societies. Data on child mortality is less commonly provided, but the reports that do exist show that mortality between ages of 1 and 5 are 50% lower in Ankole than they are in Buganda. Ankole did have slightly higher adult mortality rates than their neighbours, but not significantly so, not substantially so. So this issue of overperformance has to be explained, and it seems likely that Ankole benefited from Uganda's unusually high commitment to preventive healthcare by colonial African standards. In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, Uganda's medical department made a strategic decision to transfer funds away from curative healthcare and invest it in preventive medicine. In Tanganyika, by contrast, preventive healthcare was more or less ended during the 1930s because it was thought there wasn't enough money to keep the hospitals going and do anything else. Uganda led the way in East Africa in terms of mass vaccination against preventable disease. It invested more in the provision of sanitation and clean water than its neighbours. And decades of propaganda seem to have made an impact by the late colonial period in terms of the hygienic nature of food preparation, washing of hands before participating in childbirth, and so on and so on. There is the data on the purchase of soap shows a massive increase in the 1940s and 1950s, for example. Preventive healthcare provision was much more democratic than curative healthcare. Investment in curative healthcare tended to focus on the wealthiest parts of colonial societies, the parts of societies that were closer to the capital, for example. Whereas preventive healthcare, the expenditure was distributed very evenly across the entire country. So Ankole benefited more from preventive investment than they would have done from an equivalent curative investment by the Ugandan central government. It's worth also emphasising that the quality of curative healthcare provision in Africa, certainly in the interwar period, was not thought by its providers to be extremely good. The director of medical services in Tanganyika in the late 1930s wrote that most curative provision was a waste of effort. In Buganda, inpatient mortality data indicate that not until the 1950s could curative medicine claim to have radically transformed survival chances. Data from maternity clinics provide the best evidence of this fundamental shift. At Kampala's largest maternity units, maternal mortality per thousand fell from an average of 45 between 1924 and 1949 to 5 from 1954 to 69. So 1950 to 69. Over the same period, neonatal mortality fell from 8% to 3%, and portion of babies who were stillborn fell from 13% to 3%. And partly this is again due to the nature of the data that attendance at maternity centres did increase substantially over this period, but the shift in mortality patterns doesn't map precisely at all onto the period when attendance really increases. Instead, it seems that there is a major shift in the quality of care from 1950 or so. So in the late 1940s, it becomes standard procedure that women attending rural antenatal centres would be transferred to the major hospitals in Kampala if they were identified as being at risk of disproportion, if they were of small stature. In the early 1950s, the lower segment cesarean section was introduced. Vacuum extraction was brought in the 1960s. The early 50s also saw the introduction of tube feeding for neonates. Also the use of penicillin, blood transfusions. So what you get is a very, very different likelihood that women and babies would survive childbirth in hospital in this period around 1950. So, for example, between 1950 and 1960, the risk that disproportion would end with maternal death and stillbirth fell from 90 to 25%. Some of the reasons why fertility in Uganda started to rise in the 1950s is simply that far fewer women died during childbirth. So it's not that. So women are living for much longer and producing children for a longer period. In Bahia too, fertility rose and infant mortality fell with remarkable rapidity from the 1950s, in large part due to a restructuring of medical provision to focus on maternal and child health, and the universal provision of STD treatment. Antibiotics' role in reducing sterility was also thought to result from a remarkable decline in the incidence of postpartum infections. This is also partly due to broader increases in the take-up of antenatal care and medicalized delivery. So in Uganda and Bahia, by the mid-1950s, about 90% of women went to antenatal clinics. So there's very intense provision in these societies by this time. Of equal importance in Bahia was the decline in the frequency of marital breakdown, with risk of divorce halving between 1953 and 1973. In Uganda, by contrast, It was an increase in reproduction outside marriage which drove birth rates upwards. Age-specific fertility rates for 15 to 9-year-olds and 35 to 39-year-olds rose by approximately two-thirds between 1959 and 69, as the stigma of giving birth before and after marriage reduced. In all three societies, then, the key approximate determinants of high fertility were those that influenced the duration, not the inception or pace of reproduction. So just to conclude, the overall argument of this paper is that modernization or development had unpredictable demographic consequences in this region. While the analysis today has relied on the use of a mass of statistics of variable quality, the project as a whole has endeavored to focus on individuals' experience of demographic change and how their evolving social attitudes have shaped their actions. People in this region have understood modernity in ways that were formed by local culture and experience. And understanding the ways in which modernity was hybridized is key to explaining the demographic growth in this era in Africa. Thank you very much.